Good morning. I'm Michael Green. I'm the clerk of Green's List. I have to start with an apology. Our chairman this morning was to be the senior property law member of the list, Namal Wickrama SC. He rang me as I was walking up the street to say that his car has not started for him, and as he's just spent $5,000 on it, he is fuming. So Namal does apologise for not being here. And he gave me a bit of his introduction, which was far more eloquent than you're going to hear from me. Mine will be very practical. Now, our first presenter this morning, it is property law, as you know. Our first presenter is Sam Hopper. Sam's been in practice for now coming up about 10 years and been at the bar about 7 years. Sam has a commercial practice, which is predominantly, or the major portion of his commercial practice, is in property law, and hence he brings a great deal of expertise to what he's going to speak to us about this morning. The paper you've got there from Sam is a very comprehensive paper. Retail leases update, assignments, repairs, maintenance and market reviews, or market rent reviews. But I think the major part of Sam's presentation this morning will be on set off and rent payable without deduction. Some of the other topics in his paper he will touch on, but maybe not go through as fully, and therefore he leaves you with his very comprehensive paper to fully read at your own leisure. Sam Hopper.
Thank you, everybody. You might have noticed already I'm a touch husky, and that could be something of an understatement. I actually lost my voice earlier in the week, and it's come back over the last 24 hours, so if you can be as patient with me as you can, I'd appreciate it. It reminds me, though, losing my voice, of the first brief I ever got, which was a claim for make-good costs after termination of a lease, and Michael Green sent the brief through to me at about 4:30 the day before the trial, which should set off a warning bell in anybody's book. And I worked up the papers and got home at about 11 o'clock that night, walked in the door to say hello to my wife, and instead of saying, "Hello, honey, I'm home," I went, "Ah," and I had completely lost my voice. It might have had something to do with the sheer terror of my first trial. Anyway, I rang around some friends from the reader's course, which was a pretty futile exercise because I didn't have any voice. Finally, I got one who got onto a mate who could hear me, and he agreed to come and speak for me while I told him, sat beside him at the bar table and told him what to say. And when we appeared at court, he got to announce the best appearance that I've ever heard, and I'm kicking myself that I didn't get to say it myself. He got up and he said, "Your Honour, my name's Gillard, and I kind of appear for the plaintiff, but I don't have a brief. My learned friend, Mr. Hopper, sitting beside me, he's got a brief, but he hasn't got a voice, and between the two of us, Your Honour, we make up a whole barrister." Now, as Michael said, I've given you a paper that Michael's politely described as a comprehensive paper on update on commercial and retail leasing. I'd describe it in a more disparaging fashion as a hodgepodge of issues that have come across my desk over the last couple of years and that I think might be relevant or useful for people who practice in this area. But there's a lot of material in there. I won't touch on the bulk of it. I'm going to talk to you today about a case that's currently reserved by the full federal court that was heard by the full federal court on the 2nd of March, and that was heard by Justice Finkelstein, an appeal from a decision by Justice Finkelstein in December. And it's to do with a managed investment scheme, but it gives rise to a leasing issue that I think is relevant to a very large number of leasing disputes. Now, the case was involving the Forest Enterprise Australia Managed Investment Scheme. Some of you might remember it as the Tasmanian Plantations Managed Investment Scheme, which was a timber plantation scheme that started in Tasmania and moved its way across the north of Australia as well. And the case involved, there was a lot of argy-bargy about what in fact was the leasehold structure of the scheme, but basically it's a trust-based managed investment scheme built on a leasehold structure. And to make it a little bit easier to understand, I've prepared a very highly sophisticated drawing on the whiteboard. There are four relevant entities in the case. The top of the diagram here is described as TASP. That's Tasmanian Plantations, and that's the land-owning company within the group. Beneath that is a subsidiary company called FEA, and beneath that, helpfully, is another subsidiary company called FEAP. And FEAP is the responsible entity or trustee of the schemes, and the beneficiary of the schemes are the growers who are down the bottom here with a whole lot of arrows pointing towards them. And the way the leasehold structure worked was Tasmanian Plantations granted a head lease to FEA, FEA granted a sublease to FEAP, who is also responsible entity and trustee, and then FEAP granted a series of subleases to each of the growers and that who also had rights as beneficiaries. Now, the group collapsed. When the group collapsed, the first three companies went into liquidation. But importantly, as well as going into liquidation, receivers and managers were appointed to the top two companies. And in order to try and... The receivers and managers latched onto what was obviously the most valuable asset in this structure, which is the freehold at the top of the tree. Now, they, of course, wanted to sell the freehold unencumbered, so they wanted to get rid of all the leases below. Now, they would quite easily be able to dispose of this leasehold interest here. The challenge was getting rid of this leasehold interest here, which would inevitably extinguish the growers' rights down here. So they served notices and sought to terminate that lease for non-payment of rent. And because they are receivers and managers, they've got the ability to go to the court and obtain protection by seeking judicial advice, and they asked the court, are we justified as receivers and managers in terminating these leases for non-payment of rent? Now, the administrators, who, although appointed to all the companies, were relevantly acting for this company here, also had duties to my clients, who are the growers down here. Now, this company, and this is where some of the complexities of the case get a little bit twisty-turny, but this company, because it has certain obligations, has an Australian Financial Services licence under the Corporations Act, it has certain financial hurdles that it has to overcome in order to obtain its licence. One of the ways it overcame that hurdle was to obtain what was described as a letter of comfort from another company within the group, saying that another company in the group with more assets than it had would answer debts up to some millions of dollars on a month-by-month basis if and when required. Helpfully for my clients, the growers, that letter of comfort just happened to have come from FEA, which is the company that was alleging rental arrears and trying to terminate the lease. So, I'll return to my lectern. The administrators said, well, we'll make a call on that letter, and you ask for, we'll call it $1 million worth of rent, but we'll just ask you under the letter of comfort for that $1 million worth of rent back, and we'll cross a line through the debts, they'll set each other off. Now, you can imagine the sort of arguments that were coming up about the characterisation of the letter of comfort and whether it was a contractually enforceable document or whether it was just a unilateral, an unenforceable representation. But the relevant part of the case for our purposes today was that the lease between FEA and FEAP said that FEAP would pay rent without deduction. Didn't say any more. Said they'll pay rent without deduction. Now, I presume most of the people here are property lawyers, so you'll be familiar with the various forms that a rental covenant will take. Sometimes you just pay the rent, sometimes you pay the rent without deduction, sometimes you pay the rent without any deduction whatsoever, sometimes you pay the rent without any deduction, set off, counterclaim, cross claim, or of any kind. The interesting part of this case was that it was limited to those words without deduction and there was nothing more, and importantly, there was no express reference to a set off, yet it was a set off that the administrators were claiming. Now, in Victoria in the mid-90s, there was a decision of a single judge in the Supreme Court that said that the words... Oh, in fact, I'll go back a step first. It is possible to contract out of a right to claim an equitable set-off. But there's some controversy in the cases over the precise wording that's required to contract out of it. There was a single judge decision from the Supreme Court of Victoria that held that the words without deduction on their own are sufficient. There was also a decision of Deputy President McNamara in VCAT to the same effect. However, in around 2002, there was an unreported application for an injunction that recognised that there might be an arguable case on the point. And there was a decision from the New Zealand High Court and and from the English Court of Appeal saying that the words without deduction are not sufficient to contract out of an equitable set-off and you have to expressly refer to a set-off in order to exclude it. There are also a couple of other decisions, including a Western Australian decision, recent decision that recognised the controversy. Now, all of these decisions were put before Justice Finkelstein, who said that if it were up to him, his view is that the words without deduction are sufficiently clear to exclude an equitable set-off. But in his view, he was bound, and he used the word bound, interestingly. He was bound by appeal court decisions from New Zealand and England, even though there are none in Australia, to conclude that that you need the additional words or set-off within your rental clause to expressly exclude the equitable set-off. Decision went on appeal. Three judges of the full federal court. As I said, it was heard on the 2nd of March. Court is still reserved and we've got no word as to when the decision's coming down, but it will be the first appeal court decision on this point within Australia. And although strictly not binding in Victoria, a full federal court decision is obviously highly persuasive on a Victorian court. Now, the obvious thought a lot of you will be having now is, well, how is this going to be relevant to an ordinary retail, leasing or commercial landlord-tenant dispute that doesn't have the complexities of a case like this? The answer is it's actually one of the most important issues that comes up in most landlord-tenant disputes over the termination of a lease that come across my desk. There's four ways that you terminate, that you resist the termination of a lease. Say you're acting for a tenant. The first way is you challenge the formalities of the notice. Not a particularly... it's a fairly short-term strategy, but one that can work. Second thing is you can attack the factual substrate behind the notice. You say, no, I'm not in rental arrears, or no, I didn't breach, whatever it happens to be. The third way is you seek relief from forfeiture by curing the breach, paying the arrears and seeking the benevolent, and throwing yourself at the mercy of the court. Or the fourth, which is by far the most common in my experience, is you come up with a counterclaim, particularly when the landlord is trying to terminate for non-payment of rent, come up with a counterclaim that is equal to or exceeds the amount of rental arrears that are being claimed. Now, because of the special nature of a lease, you've got to, if you're using that fourth strategy, you can't just run any old counterclaim in order to prevent your landlord from terminating the lease. If you've got, say you've got a complex, you know, an ongoing relationship with your landlord, and you say, I've fallen into rental arrears, I'm $100,000 behind, and it's for occupying a building in our premises in Owen Dixon West. But you're also warehousing some of my goods in West Melbourne, and because of the way, because of your negligence in warehousing those goods over there, you owe me $150,000. So I'll set that off against the rent. That doesn't work, because the rental covenant and the ability to terminate the lease for non-payment of rent is part of the landlord's security under the rental under the lease itself. So to raise a counterclaim as a set-off against rent, it has to be an equitable set-off. That means there has to be an intimate relationship between the nature of your rental of your counterclaim and the lease itself. They either have to arise out of the same transaction, or they have to be so intimately connected that the counterclaim has to be so intimately connected to the rent as to render it unconscionable for the landlord to enforce the rental covenant without first dealing with the counterclaim. The classic case of a landlord's of a counterclaim causing an equitable set-off is in the retail shopping context. The landlord's, the tenant's fallen into arrears, call it $100,000. Landlord goes to terminate. The tenant says, well, I was the recipient of representations by the landlord or the landlord's agents about the number of people that were going to walk past this airlock-like automatic door every day. You told me it was going to be 5,000 people an hour. In fact, it's 5 people an hour. I relied on that representation. I entered into the lease. In reliance on those representations, I've exposed myself to all of this rent that I can't afford to pay. So it's your misrepresentation that causes my impecuniosity and my inability to pay rent. And that's the sort of case that you run against a landlord who's trying to terminate for non-payment of rent. Now, if you say if Justice Finkelstein's decision is upheld, and the words "without deduction" are not sufficient to contract out of a set-off, then anyone with those words in their lease can run the sort of argument that I'm talking about. However, if his decision is overturned, and the words "without deduction" on their own are sufficient to exclude an equitable set-off, then any tenant who has a lease with those words in the rental covenant is going to find it extremely difficult to run an equitable set-off in the nature of the claim I've just outlined to resist an attempt to terminate the lease. Now, to illustrate why I think that's important, until about 3 or 4 months ago, the Law Institute standard lease contained the words "without deduction," but didn't expressly refer to an equitable set-off, and a very large number of precedents around Melbourne at least, and probably around Australia, had the same thing. They included the words "without deduction." They didn't include an express reference to the word "set-off." So we'll wait and see what the full federal court has to say, but whichever way it goes, it has the potential to have a significant impact on a number of landlord and tenant disputes around the country. In the meantime, the question is, what should you guys be doing as lawyers who are... ..who are settling or reviewing leases? And I think the prudent thing is this: if you're acting for a landlord, you should always check the rental covenant to make sure there is an express reference to an exclusion of a right to claim set-off in the rental covenant. It's only requires a couple of words. Usually the rent is payable without deduction. Just put in the words "or set-off." And, in fact, "or equitable set-off" is even better. If, on the other hand, you're acting for a tenant, look in the rental covenant for the same phenomenon. If there is an exclusion in the rental covenant of the right to claim an equitable set-off, it is prudent to firstly advise your tenant of the risks of those words being in the lease, because they can be very damaging down the track. And secondly, so far as it is possible, and there's always limits to this, you should try and negotiate with the landlord to exclude those words. The problem when it comes to a negotiation, of course, is that landlords would be wary to remove the words from the rental covenant because it allows the rogue tenant to obtain leverage against the landlord. Alternatively, a tenant's reluctant to have the words in there because, of course, it allows a rogue landlord to take advantage of his own abuse in the event that you do have a legitimate set-off counterclaim. All right, that's really the main point that I wanted to raise with you today. It's a very long explanation for what is ultimately a very short point, and I'll repeat it, that is check your rental covenant and make sure that you're aware of the importance of the words set-off in that following the words without deduction, usually in clause 2 of your lease. I'll just grab a copy of my paper. I've only got 5 minutes to go. In fact, that's not my paper. Have you got my paper? Perhaps I'll... Thank you. I might start by asking if anybody's got any questions on arising out of that topic. I'm never sure whether no questions is a good or a bad sign. Could also mean that no one can hear my voice at the back of the room, but... Okay, as I said, short, long explanation for a fairly short point. The other topics in my paper, and I'm aware of the lack of time, are assignments, repair and maintenance, and current market rent reviews. Again, does anybody have any particular questions on that area that they'd like to address to me now? Otherwise, I'll pick a few random points that I'll make out of the paper that I think are important. All right, if you turn to... Repair and maintenance is probably the hottest issue under the Retail Leases Act. The first topic, starting on page 9, or first subtopic, is determining the condition of the premises under section 52 of the Retail Leases Act. Now, unlike most rental covenants you see in leases, section 52 implies into all retail leases a covenant that the landlord will maintain the premises in a condition consistent with the premises at the commencement of the lease, or in fact when the lease was entered into, which is a defined term under the Act. Now, that's what we call a keep-in repair and not a put-in repair covenant. For a long time, it's one of those typical retail leasing concepts, easy to say and very hard to enforce, because when you have a brand-new property, it's very easy to... it creates a very clear benchmark as to what the condition of the property is. But when you have a property that is in a steady state of decay, as, you know, many properties are around town, it's very difficult to say what the condition of the property was when the lease was entered into. Is the landlord obliged, for example, to repair the roof? If the roof starts to leak very badly, but was leaking only a little bit when the lease was entered into, is the landlord required to improve the roof so that it only leaks a little bit, or is he entitled to, or is he required to completely fix the roof? Now, in the recent case of Computer and Parts Land and Ost China Yan Tai Proprietary Limited, Senior Member Lothian went to some length to try and explain the operation of the section. One of the points that she makes in the decision, some of them I think are intuitively correct, some of them I have a bit more difficulty with. And they're listed at paragraph 44 of the paper, which is on page 10. Now, the first interesting point is that subparagraph A, the decision suggests that the tenant's knowledge of any defects in the premises is not relevant to the operation of section 52. It's an important one for practitioners. If there's a defect that your tenant is not aware of when they enter into possession of the property, they might be stuck with it. So to the extent that it's possible, it's prudent to advise your tenant clients to have to thoroughly inspect the premises before entering into a lease. The second one I have a bit more difficulty with. In this particular case, the landlord and tenant, that the roof was defective, and the landlord and tenant had actually entered into a separate agreement to upgrade the roof after the lease was commenced, which meant that although the roof was in a particular condition when the lease was entered into, there was a collateral agreement to improve it. The member found that the condition of the premises for the purpose of Section 52 is determined by reference to what was in fact demised, and that makes perfect sense, but also from the intention of the parties. Now, that's a fairly difficult concept. I won't labour it too hard other than to say it just seems to be inconsistent with Section 52 of the Act, which is a section you can't contract out of. The third point, subsection C, the landlord didn't have an obligation to put the premises into a particular state of repair under Section 52. And the fourth point, he's not obliged to redesign or improve the premises. However, the final point E, which is also important, is that sometimes the obligation to repair can, in extreme circumstances, mean replacement if it's the only way to continue to keep the particular item of plant or equipment working. In that particular case, it was an air conditioner. Landlord said the air conditioner's tenant said the air conditioner's deteriorating, and the landlord said, well, I can patch it up and keep repairing it because that's consistent with the condition of the premises when the lease was entered into. The member said, eventually you might have to replace it. You don't have to improve it, you only have to replace like with like, but eventually decay gets to such a point where it has to be replaced. I see the time there, so unless anyone's thought of any other questions they want to raise with me. I have one.
I do. In relation to the new disclosure statement.
Yes.
Yeah. Being who the anchor tenants are, what information that's required. Do you just kind of skip over it and say
that
we don't have that info?
That's a really big problem with the new disclosure statements. That's the first time I've heard someone raise it in the context of a franchisor, but it's a perfectly relevant point. Yeah, because we also see it in the context of an assignor of a lease. And Section 62 of the Retail Leases Act creates a very powerful protection for assignors of a lease because it creates it releases them from any lingering liability, both the assignor and the guarantor, which under common law and the terms of most assignment deeds, they remain liable for the assignee's breaches. But in order to satisfy, in order to fill out to trigger Section 62, you've got to fill out the disclosure statement, which has things about anchor tenant, and in fact, the back of my paper has the disclosure statement in it. It also asks them for landlord's representations.
Yeah.
And how's a tenant going to know that?
Do we just have to watch this paper and wait to see what happens?
I think the only thing you can do is, in the assigning tenant's circumstances, the best strategy I know of is to write to the landlord, tell them what you intend to do, ask them to give you a disclosure statement and tell them you're going to rely on it. And to the extent that the landlord fails to disclose or misleadingly discloses, it's the landlord who's going to be suing you for the assignee's breaches. So you'll raise an estoppel argument against them. But you're talking about a disclosure to your franchisee, and the franchisee is then going to complain to you, and you're going to rely on the landlord's representations in a fight between you and the franchisee.
But the franchisor can't compel the landlord to give it.
I know.
So the problem that I'm facing in my practice, probably 90% of my clients are franchisors, is that I can't get the information from the landlord. I can't compel the landlord to give it to me. I have to comply with the obligations to disclose under the Act in that new form.
Are you assigning the lease at that point, or are you just granting a sublease or a
license?
And there's nothing in the code that'll help you, is there?
No, there's nothing. It's one of those loopholes. They sort of franchise relationship, and a franchisor in the Act, yet they don't make it practically helpful for franchisors in the context of trying to comply with their obligation as a licensor and a licensee relationship.
I don't know what you can do, actually. Come and talk to me a bit afterwards. I'll see if we can nut something out. But that's even worse than the problem for an assigning tenant, I think. Yeah.
And I'm facing it on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and you get a difficult landlord and there's nothing you can do.
No.
Yeah, well, chat to me afterwards. I'll see if we can come up with something.
We've got a situation where the building, the landlord, gets flooded during the term of the lease, and then the tenant's been they had to shut. It's a restaurant. They had to shut. Wasn't the tenant's fault because he was one or two four flights down and flooded and started the bar. So flooded the whole restaurant. My client, the leases run out, you know, that bit where you say, well, I'll give you a new lease. And we're saying, we'll give you a new lease as long as you just wear that and you can come forward. You never sort of make a claim against us when you had to close the restaurant. Can you do that as part of the lease?
Oh, I think that might. Has he already got an option?
No, what I'm saying, the lease is completely coming.
Yeah. Gotta be careful. That might be key money.
Yeah, you reckon you could make
it might be that the release itself is actually a form of key money,
right,
which is prohibited under the Act. It's actually an offence to even demand it.
Okay. Right.
You're for the tenant, did you say?
No, the landlord.
Yeah, you'd want to be careful with that.
Yeah.
Key money is, I think it's about section 11 or 13 or something in the Act. Which is a payment or other consideration for the grant of a lease for which there's no other real consideration.
Yeah, okay.
And I had a situation where a landlord and tenant had been arguing about who was responsible for an upgrade to the lift. And in that case, the tenant wanted to assign, sought the landlord's consent to the assignment. The landlord said, I'll only consent to the assignment if you pay for the upgrade to the lift. The tenant said no. They said, all right, we'll put the money in a trust account, and had this really convoluted deed setting out this process. And by the time it came to me, I said, look, this is the demand. The demand for the repair costs is indirect key money. It's an offence. And we reported him to the commissioner, and he eventually wandered off. So just be quite cautious with that. Any other questions? All right, I think I'm 5 minutes over time, so thank you for your patience with my voice and for a copy of my own paper.